You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
If a tree falls but there's no one in the forest to hear it, does it make a sound? If a great film is made but no one is able to see it, does it exist? I'm Mick Garris, and this is the Postmortem Podcast. Painters, musicians, singers, or filmmakers, artists can't work in a vacuum. Your work means nothing if it doesn't reach an audience. Today's audiences are increasingly fractured, splintered, divided, and conquered. Movies either get giant releases on thousands of screens at a time, or they are ordered online like a pizza. The millions of dollars it takes to promote a Hollywood film requires the edges to be sanded off to appeal to the widest audience possible. But still, there are independents who can deliver smaller films with bigger ideas than the giant 3D theme park rides that fill the multiplexes today. Film production and distribution are in a state of constant upheaval and evolution. The formulas aren't always working, yet the unique vision can still break through all the clutter and make a giant noise all on its own. Robert Shea is the dictionary definition of independent. He started New Line Cinema in his Greenwich Village apartment in 1967, renting titles like Reefer Madness to college campuses. New Line started to acquire distribution rights to various foreign art house films and eventually wrapped up into producing as well as distributing movies, having phenomenal success, particularly in the horror genre, most explosively in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. New Line is still achieving great success in the horror world, releasing movies like Annabelle Creation and, maybe most importantly, It, though Shea sold and left the company a decade ago. New Line was always gambling, seeking out something new. They were able to cling to their roots and still roll the dice on huge ventures like Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy when no one else dared to take a chance. I directed my first feature film, the timeless classic Critters 2, for Bob Shea and New Line, and have always felt deep appreciation for Bob and his idiosyncratic company. And it's time for you to meet the man who allowed Wes Craven, Peter Jackson, and many other visionaries blaze cinematic trails after this.
This is Postmortem with Mick Garris.
How New Line started. You were, like, in Greenwich Village, and you decided to do something out of your apartment, right?
Sort of. I mean, what happened was that I was really actually interested in being a director, if I tell the truth. And I had directed a short film that that was quite successful, and it won a prize it was called the Rosenthal Competition at Columbia University, ostensibly for, and a little bit of a hyperbole, for the best film by a filmmaker under the age of 25, an American guy. But I had to share it that year with a guy named Marty Scorsese.
I've heard of him, yeah.
I did too. Actually, I hear more and more about him. But anyhow, so that was kind of the beginning, and I couldn't get distribution for the short. And I took a job at the Museum of Modern Art, which was the only job I could find in the film business in New York, through meeting Willard Van Dyke through a mutual friend. And Willard hired me to head the film stills archive, which was something I knew nothing about. But it was a job, and I was studying to take the bar examination at the same time, so it was as close as I could get to the movie business at that moment. One of the perks was to get invited to all the parties that the film department at MoMA had. At that time, Janus Films had just started a collection of short films that they were putting on as a special event at colleges. And it was launched at Lincoln Center. They turned down my film, and so I wasn't going to take no for an answer, supposedly, although subsequently I learned to do that. But at the time, I was still kind of feisty. So at one of these parties, somebody was talking to me about this phenomenon of special events at universities. I said, well, I could find films to do it. I just don't know how to get them distributed. And they said, well, you put the program together, and we'll show you how to distribute it. So I put together program notes for them, the first four films, and that's the first I'm pointing out to Mick, the brochure that my girlfriend designed, right over there, New Films for the New Audience. And I became a film distributor, and I put, of course, my films in the package, which was the object of the exercise.
That's kind of something I did when I was in a band. Our first gig, I was booking this concert with actual recording acts, and booked us to open. Yeah. Kind of the same deal.
Well, anyhow, so and what I did is I found two, I was at this party for this Czech festival, and I found the American rep for Czech movies, and he made a deal with me because I didn't have any place else to go to take two films that I rather liked, one by Jan Nemec and one by Jan Schmidt, and gave them to me for 50-50 for a year for non-theatrical only. And the idea was of putting together a real program with short films as well as features, including my shorts, of course. And then, as I was pointing out, the program notes that we had that were called Seymour, get it? And my girlfriend did the brochure, which I just pointed out to you, too. And I got a mailing list of Student Activities Office, and there I was on 14th Street and 2nd Avenue as a film distributor.
How did your passion for film begin?
It's kind of intrinsic to my being. I often think of the luck that I had in knowing what I wanted to do from when I was really a very young age. I suspect you did to some extent, too. It's just something I always wanted to do. And my dad had a 16-millimeter camera, as every dad did, and a Revere. And, we made home movies. And then my dad was really, he was great because he never got in my way. He actually, in fact, nurtured me. I got involved making money in high school with still photography, doing pictures of dances and demolé things engagements to my friends' older sisters and stuff like that. And my dad let me build a dark room in our basement, and so I started off doing still photography. And then one day he wanted me to get into the grocery business, and supermarkets eventually is where he and his brothers moved on to. And I worked as a carryout boy, which is a packing boy, whatever they call it, in Detroit, actually on 8 Mile Road, for one summer. So he asked me if I wanted to make a training film for carryout boys, and I did. And it was with title cards and no sound and no negative. It was just color, reversal film in a cartridge, and it was spliced together with a little editing machine.
The tapes
and stuff. Yeah. The film has disappeared, but it was really that really got me my start. And it's just always been what I to sound a little maybe disingenuous about it, but I really get a kick out of turning other people on. I mean, what you got to do is be sure that you manage the exercise and not turn people off.
Right.
But that's what really excites me in life, and so movies seem to me to be the most exciting. I wanted to be an actor first.
Really?
Yeah, but I was smart enough to know. This is one of the first rules I learned. You got to know what you can do well and what you can't do well. And I realized that I was a terrible actor.
So you let your sister take that part of the game.
Yes. Letter. She went off on her own devices. But my mother kind of thought of herself as a bit of a prima donna, I guess.
Your mother came from Russia. Do you think that had anything to do with your kind of entrepreneurial spirit, that kind of
No, actually,
first
it may
generation?
Have come from the other side, which was, it wasn't so much entrepreneurial spirit. It wasn't about making money, becoming wealthy or anything. It was about independence.
Well, that's a really important point, because one of the hallmarks of New Line under your leadership was independence and outside of the norm. You did not do the easy gambles. Sometimes there were things that maybe were more obvious than others. But are you attracted to the outre, the things that are a little not the mainstream necessarily?
Well, let me say I appreciate them, and I suppose that there is a vein of interest and fascination with the outre, as you put it. The truth is, it sounds very mundane and a bit boring. That was just about the only stuff that we didn't have any money. We started off with $500. It was just finding out what I thought I could sell and how I could get it as cheaply as possible. And so it was usually the outre stuff that was there. When John Waters sent me Pink Flamingos, it wasn't because I went looking for it. They just say, well, this has got some weird stuff in it, and maybe, you know, you'll let me distribute it for nothing.
Not as much competition to get hold of it. Yeah.
Well, it's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, here I was, arguably a little jerk in New York City who just, you know, somehow got talked into going to law school. And what I wanted to do was go to work for Sam Arkoff. This gets back to the independent spirit idea. Yeah. And, I mean, American International Pictures and Roger Corman and Sam Arkoff were my real idols.
Wow.
And so I sent Sam Arkoff, who was also a lawyer, a letter saying, I just graduated from law school and I'd like to come to work for you for nothing. I'd like to just be an unpaid intern. And he never answered the letter. So, frankly, it pissed me off. And I said, well, I don't need to, you know, I'll do it myself, having no clue what was really entailed. A lot of people said, you're out of your mind and stupid and don't do that. And the grocery business is there. My dad offered me $100,000 a year. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And but I, of course, I believed it because I had no interest in it.
Well, the passion is what has to drive you. If you're a creative person, to deny that side of your psyche seems to be...
I'm not downplaying it. I'm not the guy who wears, velvet capes.
Right, yeah.
I really do think of movies as a craft.
Mm-hmm.
That, like architecture is what I've often thought about it, that has a primary objective that's practical, whether it's living in a building or that's entertaining. But that every so often, the really good stuff rises above craftsmanship to art. And so that's a very exciting thing to be in. And actually, I think a lot of businesses and a lot of occupations, a lot of human activity can start off as just being very simple, but have the potential to achieve a kind of artistry.
Well, who were some of the people, some of the cinema artists who inspired you as a young filmmaker?
Lewis Miles Stone. This is a movie that I saw on television when I was brought up in the era of television when they had the 12-inch screen, and at the beginning of my television career, I had to go to a store on Livernois and 7 Mile because nobody had a television in their house, and you saw they had television screens in the window, in the show windows. So you stood outside at night watching shows on television like Howdy Doody and stuff like that. But I saw this movie with my dad in our living room when we got a TV, and I broke into tears at the end. It was so moving. My father couldn't even understand why, because he was a real craftsman. Right. He didn't have, his emotionality was very subdued and controlled. It was my mother who was the hysteric. And that's why my sister takes after my mother.
You take more after your father, would you say? But you seem to have a sentimental
side. For the good
side.
Or the bad, I take more after my mother. But I did get a lot of strength and belief in myself from my dad. And maybe not enough humanity, but he was a great human being.
Any of the rebels at the time of your youth that were kind of happening? I mean, you mentioned
Rebel Scorsese. Without a Cause and the Wild One,
Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando. I mean, then I'm working with Marlon Brando 40 years after that. That was quite a trip. But I guess people change over time.
Well, New Line has found tremendous success from its earliest times with horror. And especially when the company started to produce it. Was horror something you were interested in creatively, or was that mostly a commercial decision?
It was something that I felt that I understood because I get scared, I get horrified easily. What interests me personally is fantasy. Hmm. I am a huge fantasist. In fact, when I was in grade school, I put on a radio production of Invasion from Mars. I had the original Wells script in a pocketbook.
Right, War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds, yeah. And I've always just loved that stuff. And maybe things that you may or may not recall, but there were great radio shows. I was brought up also in the real halcyon era of radio. And there were shows like Dimension X and Suspense and The Hermit's Cave and Green Hornet, of course, and Lone Ranger, too. But that's a different kind of fantasy that doesn't really interest me so much. But it's the science fiction stuff that I always loved. And my dad was constantly on my case to be reading classic books. And all I was reading was comics.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I stumbled onto science fiction and got completely engrossed in it. My father was delighted because I would hang out at the local branch of the public library in Detroit. There was one shelf where the new science fiction things would, when they came in, and I got a tip that something was coming in that was really hot, would, you know, grab it before somebody else took it out.
So like Arthur C. Clarke or Ray Bradbury or Heinlein, Robert Heinlein. Well, fantasy turned out to be one of the biggest gambles that New Line ever made was when Peter Jackson came in and pitched you Lord of the Rings, which nobody wanted to do the way he wanted to do it. Didn't he pitch it as two movies and you told him, let's do the trilogy?
Yes, well, I mean, there's a lot of sane backstory to that. It's not just some kind of, you know, craziness, as a lot of people accuse me of indulging in.
Oh, it's obviously not a crazy decision.
Well, yeah. But it was more than that. Mike DeLuca, who is a guy that I love and I'm incredibly proud of, who came to work at New Line and with me, particularly when he was 19 or 20.
He was 21 when we were doing Critters too.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was just around then. I was only 31 or something, wasn't I? I wasn't much older, but yeah, we used to brag that there was nobody in the company over 30. And then at the end of the time, he was the only guy under 30. But DeLuca had, to my mind, gone off on a bit of a creative fancy that was not really resonating with where our company was at the time. We needed movies that were making money, and we cared about box office, and it wasn't just a total far-out contemporaneous, you know, fantasy and inspiration. Right. So Lord of the Rings came in. Weinstein had bought it, as thought he was very wise in going, selling his company to Disney, and I thought that that was really a bright idea. But Weinstein had it, and then he got Saul Zance. Saul Zance had the rights to Lord of the Rings, but then he did The English Patient.
Ah.
And it was Peter who brought him Heavenly Creatures. And I knew Peter because he had written one of the sequels to Nightmare on Elm Street, one that we didn't use.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
It was not a particularly good script. But he had done things like Meet the Feebles and Brain Dead and movies that were like, you know, 30,000 New Zealand kroner or whatever they New Zealand dollars.
Yeah.
But I mean, as a pragmatist, you know, one is also good. However, that wasn't the point. It wasn't so much that I was, you know, trying to hold up the flag of Tolkien and worldwide culture. I was saying we needed three films that had marketing potential. I would have made five. I mean, it was finally we had something that was, you know, saleable. I didn't have Mike DeLuca, you know, looming over me with the cap on backwards and all that stuff. When it came around to us finally, Mark Ordesky came into my office and said, "Look, Peter is coming in. He'd like to show us the pitch anyhow. So would you be interested in seeing it?" So I mean, it partly as a courtesy and partly out of curiosity, I said, "Okay, I will, but it's not happening." And he said, "Okay, it's just whatever it is." I went in and I saw the thing, and it was really terrific. He had done a short video piece with Ian McClellan, and it was very impressive. So, you know, there's lots of stories that come after that, but that was sort of the genesis.
Well, the first movies that your company made, New Line Cinema made, were Alone in the Dark, which was a horror film, Extro, and then Polyester, John Waters. So these were people, you knew their work before, you knew that you were, well, with Polyester, certainly you were going.
I knew Polyester, but Polyester was right up my alley. I mean, I saw Smell-O-Vision when I was here in Los Angeles, and Mike Todd Jr., is maybe even before your time, they actually had to convert a whole theater with giant fans.
Oh, my God.
And Peter Lorre was in it. It was called The Scent of Mystery.
Wow.
And I actually went by myself. I don't know why I was even here. So I've always loved this idea of gimmicks. What's the guy's name?
William Castle. Yeah,
I mean, all of that
the
stuff.
The Tingler and all that.
The Tingler, yeah.
But here you were able to get the scratch and sniff cards for Polyester, and I saw it with the cards, and there were some rather foul scents that you'd scratch and sniff.
Well, Sarah Risher, the dear girl who was at that point good friends with John because she's also a Southerner, and she was our head of production, as it was. We nominated her to go to 3M, which was the only company that was making scratch and sniff technology, and to try to get them to make the cards for us. She made up names instead of the number six, which was fart or something. She made up this kind of sort of very conservative, acceptable thing that John Waters is a you know, a very well-known classic filmmaker. And they said, well, does it have anything to do with polyester, the fabric? I said, well, you know, to some extent, it does.
So that you've got Tab Hunter and Divine and exactly. Scratch and Sniff. I just want to see those chemists who were working on the scents that were used on that card to do. But in the world of horror, and I want to come back to this because it's kind of the meat and potatoes of what our podcast is about. You don't need stars. You don't need, other than maybe the filmmakers themselves in that genre. Was that a consideration, one of the reasons that New Line pursued that genre so heavily?
Yeah, sure. Well, because it was what was available. And it was a generation and a society that I had some connection with. It wasn't called independent cinema. That was called underground movies, you may remember. The real genesis was a lot, and it wasn't the exact genesis, but New York was a real hub. That whole group of people really came out of New York. So those were the guys I knew. And sure, I mean, John Carpenter, when I saw Halloween in Milan, we were trying to buy films for our little company, I jumped out of the theater, ran to their office to try to buy it. Of course, it had been sold already. But, I mean, those were the guys that I knew. When I saw Night of the Living Dead, I'd never had that happen to me before. It unhinged my jaw. I was watching the movie. Never seen stuff like that. I mean, it's kind of, yeah, it is kind of porno in the sense it's just things you've never seen before that were kind of forbidden. And that was what we did. We did forbidden stuff. Reefer Madness, New York Erotic Film Festival, yep, yep, yep.
Right. Well, what seems to be the biggest change in the perception of New Line maybe started with A Nightmare on Elm Street. Tell me about how that came about, what Wes's pitch was to you.
His pitch was, don't call me. No, I had come to New York with a guy named Mark Forstatter, who was an American who lived in England. And he said, listen, you can't just be sitting here in New York trying to find little movies. You know, that if you want to really get into the business and really make movies for theaters or distribute movies for theaters, you need to find young directors. So he took me to meet Toby Hooper, Joe Dante. Mm-hmm. Wes wasn't available, but I called him. And I said, well, you know, I introduced myself. He wasn't very impressed. and he had just done Last House on the Left, which I thought was the most horrible, I mean, frightening, disgusting piece of film I'd ever seen in my entire life. I couldn't believe that I had seen that, but sort of suggested he was my kind of guy. and I called him up. And I said, well, what are you doing? I I'm just here for a little while. He said, well, I can't meet you. So he described to me Nightmare on Elm Street. And it struck me what a great thing this was, because it was the kind of thing that's in people's psyche and their understanding, because every person in the world has bad dreams. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you know the story about where Wes got the idea, it's from some Balinese dream ritual that he read about in a book. Mm-hmm. So everybody has their own version of bad dreams. But the idea of having a bad dream and the wonder of waking up from it and saying, geez, that was scary, but at least I woke up, to have a dream that you couldn't wake up from and it would die in the dream, I loved it. And so I said, well, can you send me the script? And Wes said, well, other people are looking at it, and I'll get back to you. And it took him like 9 months, as I recall it. Every month or two, finally, after everybody turned it down, just like Lord of the Rings, after it was completely dead, or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, another one, they finally said, I'm going to send you the script, sent it to us. We had a little bit of money at that time, $20,000 or something, but I think I optioned it for $5,000, and that's how we got going on it together.
Amazing. And so the term franchise was not something that was used in those days, but that became kind of the first franchise for New Line.
Yeah, we called it Lifeblood.
Lifeblood.
It's a little different. The franchises, of course. I mean, Universal had their entire library of monsters.
Right.
The Bride of Frankenstein, and they kept recycling these things, and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. But the concept of franchises and the understanding that not only is it a recyclable copyright, but also the marketing monies that are spent, which got to be getting bigger and bigger, could be used to take advantage of the momentum that the characters and theme had already sold and to bring back more to the subsequent audiences. I mean, I was not thrilled by it, frankly. I thought it was not very creative just to keep doing the same thing over and over. And the truth of the matter is, I still think that way. But there is something to fragmentism in the equation.
And it's still ongoing with the remakes and sequels to remakes and all that.
It used to be the subsequent Critters. You know, Critters 4, 5, and 6 were a little bit long in the tooth.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it really encourages production companies and distribution companies to be a little bit lazy. But, I mean, that's just a kid's way of describing means that, you know, you want to make a living, and that's the easiest way to do it.
Well, I would take exception to Nightmare on Elm Street because 3 and 4, you know, you had Frank Darabont working on the script. You had, you know, 5 or 6 people on number 4, but coming up with the most outrageous ideas, they were free to just go anywhere. And that's another thing that's appealing about this genre to me, is that you are free to throw your imagination against the wall.
That's the fantasy part. I mean, there were things that I can point to. And for me, the fantasy came out of the first in Nightmare on Elm Street. One of my modest contributions to it was the Sticky Stairs episode, which Wes was not excited about, and we shot that the last night, and he didn't want to do it. The camera department were all quitting. They weren't getting union wages, and we were not going to work past midnight, and Wes finally let me direct that little scene. It was hardly like action cut. Heather walking up the stairs and the sinking stairs.
Into the air.
Because that was a dream I had, you know, where you get stuck and you can't move. But it was like that kind of stuff. You reach into your psyche that you could still call up to your consciousness and put it into a movie. I mean, how exciting is that?
Yeah.
That still goes on. I mean, you look at Chris Nolan, for instance. I mean, it's just that he does it in a very brilliant way. But it is just pulling stuff out of, you know, out of fantasy land.
Well, and movies are images, you know, they're ideas, they can be stories, they can be all these things, but they're limitless in where you can take them.
Which is what's the exciting thing about it. I mean, radio was too, but as I said, I was really weaned on my fantasy from radio, an enormous catalyst to imagination, enormous.
I will always be indebted to you because you were the first guy to offer me a greenlit feature as a director. And it was, you know, please rewrite it the way you see it and all of that. And that opportunity was so great. At the time, I was writing for Steven Spielberg. You had had some success with the first Critters. And I always had the feeling that because Critters was sort of a Spielbergian movie, that might have been one of the reasons I was brought in, was because I was in the Spielberg camp.
Well, that was definitely a reason that you knew how to, you know, you knew what to do with the camera and you had some good imagination. When we first met, I don't exactly remember the circumstances, but I mean, there was kind of a personal connection. I really felt like, you know, you were a kindred spirit. You weren't too highfalutin.
That's for sure.
And so but certainly, yeah, cachet, anything you could put in a resume.
Well, it was a great opportunity for me, and the movie was a financial disaster that now is much more popular and plays festivals and all, and it was an opportunity, and I was really grateful, and when Freddy's Nightmares came along, I did the one after Toby Hooper did, and had a blast with that, and I wanted you to be the priest in that, and I remember very distinctly on the day you were the priest at this funeral in Freddy's Nightmares, I asked you, you know, how you were able to make the time to do it, because this was a very busy time for the studio. And you said, well, I want to watch, and because I want to try my hand at directing. And this was shortly before Book of Love. Mm. So tell me a little bit about that experience of your first feature film as a director, because you own the company.
Well, that, believe me, has been a burden and a benefit in equal measure. In fact, when the reviews for that movie came out, most of the pictures in the reviews didn't have a production still from the movie. They had a production still of me behind the camera, because I don't know where this guy gets off. He thinks he's supposed to be a director. He's head of the company, and, you know, it's just another vanity production. So that's always been a big bugaboo for me. I do want to back up for a moment, because I think I never told you this story, that we were trying desperately to raise some money from a pretty significant investment fund in Connecticut or somewhere. And we were getting close to actually raising a few million bucks. And Critters 2 was opening in Los Angeles. And invited me to have dinner with him. So I said, I'm going to take you. We're going to have dinner. It was on Sunset. And then we're going to go to the Hollywood cinema.
Oh, no.
And, you know, this is the first movie was a big success. And this is good. And this is the sequel. And it's going to be, I just can't wait for you to walk in.
Ouch.
And we had dinner at a little French restaurant on Sunset. And we drive over to Hollywood Boulevard. And I checked my watch because I was sure that this was a showtime.
Right.
And there was like seven people who had just bought tickets. So I said, listen, it's going to be great. You're going to see people are going to be on their feet up applauding.
We had done that test screening.
It was a 600-seat theater. There was about 14 people in the theater. Needless to say, the financing did not progress from that
point. I was responsible for the lack of a multi-million-dollar infusion.
Well, I'll tell you another story you may remember. I think we both know who wrote the original draft of that second thing.
Yeah.
And he came in. That's one of my great script-writing stories. He came in, as you said, rewriting. And
right.
I don't really remember the chronology. I think I've got this right, though. And a guy named David, I won't use his last name, who was the writer. A nice guy, and he had just written a terrific script for Arnold Copelson, I thought it was really good, that New World was producing.
And has had a lot of success as a writer and director.
Yes, that's true. But nevertheless, he walks in, I said, well, listen, David, this is really, I thought it was okay. It's a good script. So let's just talk about, some of the changes. Do you know this story?
No, I don't. This is news to me.
No, you weren't in the meeting. And he looks at me and says, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, we need some polishing and stuff like that. He said, no, you don't get it. I nailed it. I said, well, what do you mean you nailed it? He said, I'm not doing any more work. He said,
I'm done.
This is perfect. You know, this is the script, man. This is just absolutely. I said, well, listen, it's kind of a collaborative effort. And I think it really could use some work. He said, well, listen, don't talk to me. I really can't stay at this meeting. If you're going to start giving me notes again, I'm just leaving.
Oh,
so I said, well,
God.
Nice to meet you. Walked up. We didn't talk for 20 years after that.
But, wow.
So you were asking me about Book of Love.
Yeah, Book of Love.
I had read, it was from a book called Jack in the Box. I sort of thought that my ambitions as a film director, notwithstanding what anybody else may want to chime in about, were petering away. And there I was as a distributor, like I could have been in the wholesale grocery business almost, except instead of pork and beans, I was distributing you know what. I read this book that Bill Kotzwinkel had written called Jack in the Box. And he was brought up in Pennsylvania, Scranton. Mm-hmm. And I was brought up in Detroit. We're almost identical in age. And I thought this was the funniest bloody book I had read in years. It was so wonderful and so great about the teenage angst, again, of trying to find things that everybody could relate to. So, I mean, kind of like the way I started New Line, I just kind of didn't think about it. I just said, I want to direct this. And Kotzwinkel and I hit it off. We really got to be very close friends. It was my decision. I mean, Sarah was still, I think, had a production.
And, mm-hmm. And this was a coming-of-age comedy.
It was a coming-of-age comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny about movies, and I should ask you a question in return. For a long time, I've thought of myself as an entertainer who understood the contemporary tastes and what people were going for and, you know, what the hamburger of the day was in the movie business kind of thing. And I think that sometimes you miss it.
Mm.
But I've come to a conclusion, which I've fought a lot to finally decide on. The best is if you do both these things. You have to either at least make a movie for yourself or for the public. If you can do both things, which I suppose we all try to do, but at least it should resonate for yourself. And as I've joked about all the films that I've made, not that there have been that many, I still get a kick out of looking at them but it's like looking at pictures of your kids taking a bath when they're 3 years old. You know, I'm the only one who really says, oh, isn't that adorable? That was the cutest scene. I thought she did such a great job and everything like that. And the audience is like, what is this shit?
Yeah, but you're a member of the audience and I think you have to please yourself as a creator. And in your end of the business, of course, you have to figure out, is this going to be a commercial choice? But your gut tells you if it's something that appeals to you, you have to feel that it's got some universal appeal because you're not the only man standing.
That's true. You hope that. But there's also the problem of the time it takes to get you to do the things and when projects come up. And in the meantime, generations after generations are unfolding. And I mean, I just saw a movie the other day that was done by contemporary millennial. It was unintelligible. I couldn't understand. Right. I couldn't understand the dialogue. Of course, my hearing isn't that great these days. Right. But no, besides that, it was just mumble.
So do you find yourself in a generational position? Because you see everything. You're still making movies. You're still selling movies. Do you feel a sense of remove from what's happening with contemporary
art? Well, getting down to the basic stuff that we were talking about, things that are primal, I think that many of those things exist, and they continue to exist. But I think they get buried in a lot of contemporaneous detritus, really, and social stuff that comes and goes, and actors that people like and don't like. And, you know, you look back at guys like Bergman or Fellini as two of my favorites. And then you look at Steven Spielberg, who also happens to be one of my real favorites. And I think the guy is such a genius because either he hasn't forgotten what people really like, somehow he's managed to stay within the swim of contemporaneous life.
Well, I think they evolve with the population, or maybe even ahead of it.
It's possible, but there are, I mean, Samuel Goldwyn and Jack Warner, these are guys, yeah. You know, they just somehow remained kids.
Yeah.
So there is an issue about trying to at least making a film for yourself and being proud of what you did. If you make a film that you're not proud of, it really, this is a piece of junk, but I'm going to do it, and then it doesn't work, I mean, that is a big strikeout. Time and effort, and it's great fun to be making a film, but it is really bloody hard. And if you think you're just going to sail through it, you're certainly not, unless you've got $150 million and just people, you don't even have to show up for work. To make a film, you really have to think about it. You have to be consumed by it. You have to have the ecstasy and the agony of not figuring out what to do or missing a shot.
And a minimum 12-hour day, and you've got right. All of the pressures that are on you.
Right. And especially when you're shooting six-day weeks.
Yeah.
And you've only got 18 days to do it, and on top of that.
Well, which brings up a really interesting point. Because of the success you've had running a studio, selling a studio, I think you've been independent now for almost 10 years. I think it was 2008 that you went independent, something
amazing.
Like that. You are directing again. I just worked with an actor named Giles Mathey. I just directed an episode of Once Upon a Time a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about you. And you have a new film you've just made with a very young cast called Ambition. Tell me about that. You could have your choice. You could relax. You could be in Bermuda. You could be anywhere in the world right now. But you've chosen to dive back into those 12-hour days and the pressure, and it's a relatively small-scale film, I think. So tell me a little about that and your decision to jump back in.
Yeah, well, the decision was questionable. It really had to do with the fact that I was, after I left New Line, we started Unique Features with my partner, Michael Lynn. Being an independent producer, I never really was, in a sense. We had a company, and what we really were distributors, even though in my heart I thought I was a producer and a director. What we were, our bread and butter was distribution. So by the time we were making movies, I had an organization around me. But we left New Line and we started Unique. We had no organization, and we had a couple creative executives who worked, didn't work. My partner's director on a couple of boards. He's an art collector, and he makes wine and all kinds of other things. And just I happen to know him because we went to law school together. That's where the whole connection is. And you can sit in an office and call a few people. You find out, as Graydon Carter so disrespectfully said to me one time, he said, "You know, Bob, I want to warn you about something. When you lose your parking spot at the studio, your name falls off a lot of invitation lists."
Oh, wow.
And that, I mean, that you can extrapolate from that. It's true. People call up and say, yeah, or you call people and say, "Hey, how you doing, man? What's going on?" And, "Oh, Bob, great to hear from you. We'd like to send you something." And I remember back when people whose name I won't insult by telling you, I realized that now that they were kind of expired film executives whom I knew when they were heads of studios and things like that, who had gotten fired or quit or whatever it was, and were trying to be independent producers. Mm-hmm. And were sending junky scripts to me that you read one or two of them, you give them to a creative executive, you give me some coverage, and he's, are you kidding? And he's, I'm sorry, Sam, it didn't work out. And then you just don't take his calls after a while. And I saw all this happening. So when this script came in, it was awful beyond words. It's not awful beyond words now. Now it has joined one of my children in the bathtub. But it really took a lot of work to get to a place where I really believed in it. And
what was that glimmer that made you think that it was worth it?
That my very first short that got me going was called Image, which is about movies and how do they represent the reality of the filmmaker, the reality as you see it, or is the reality of the character that you don't really know. And it's this idea about leading the audience down the garden path. They think they're being told a story from one point of view, and it, in fact, has been told by another point of view. It's not necessarily an original idea. Sixth Sense did it beautifully. Marty's film, Shutter Island, does the same thing beautifully. So this was a modest acquisition of this storytelling principle, and that's what kind of got me interested in it. And I thought we put together a really nice cast. I'm going to ask you on camera, as it were. So what would Giles say to you?
He said he had a great time doing it, that he really loved working with you. And we basically had nothing but nice things to say about you back and forth. And Giles is a wonderful actor.
He's a great guy. Yeah.
And a great guy. And he was on the plane with me on the way home from Vancouver. And that's how I found out that that's what he had done with
you. He's a wonderful guy. And I hope he has a successful career. He's a very good actor. You know, not only learns his lines, but he does research and stuff.
Yes.
He did a wonderful thing. This is about a woman who wants to become a concert violinist. And he went and looked up all the things about violins, which scriptwriters had no clue about, and I had no clue about, by the way. And about so when he was in the scene where he's taunting the heroine, and he takes her violin, and he's saying, "Do you see this?" And he starts pointing at stuff. And he had researched how violins are made and everything,
so he could
ad lib extra stuff to give it more verisimilitude. Yeah, great guy.
When are you your happiest? Is it making a big deal? Is it being on a boat in the Caribbean? Is it directing? When do you feel that you're most full?
When I'm turning people on.
That's a great way to end it. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.